Bible reading is from Isaiah chapter 49, reading from verses 1 to 9. Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant nations. Before I was born, the Lord called me. From my birth, he has made mention of my name. He made my mouth like a sharpened sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me into a polished arrow and concealed me in his quiver. He said to me, "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will display my splendor." But I said, "I have labored to no purpose. I have spent my strength in vain for nothing. Yet what is due me is in the Lord's hand, and my reward is with God." And now the Lord says, "He who formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him, and gather Israel to himself, for I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has been my strength." He says, "Is it too small a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept? I will also make you light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth." This is what the Lord says, "The Redeemer and Holy One of Israel, to him who was despised and abhorred by the nation, to the servant of rulers. Kings will see you and rise up. Princes will see and bow down because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel who has chosen you." This is what the Lord says, "In the time of my favor, I will answer you, and in the days of salvation, I will help you. I will keep you and will make you to be a covenant for the people, to restore the land and to reassign its desolation inheritances, to say to the captives, 'Come out,' and to those in darkness, 'Be free.'" Our second reading is from Luke chapter 10, reading from verses 1 to 9. Jesus sends out the 72. After this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. He told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into the harvest field. Go, I am sending you out like lambs among wolves. Do not take a purse or bag or sandals, and do not greet anyone on the road. When you enter a house, first say, 'Peace to this house.' If a man of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. If not, it will return to you. Stay in that house, eating and drinking whatever they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Do not move around from house to house. When you enter a town and you are welcomed, eat what is set before you. Heal the sick who are there and tell them, 'The kingdom of God is near to you.'"
It is my great privilege this morning to introduce our guest speaker, Sheila Yukuli Paya. I first met Yukuli when I became a volunteer working with an organisation, local organisation called Fulcrum Aid. Fulcrum Aid was started by Steve Blackett, who was the pastor at the McGill Church of Christ almost a decade ago. And Yukuli was sort of my first project, so to speak. We would meet for coffee at the Flinders campus in the city, and I would listen and we would talk about and share ideas over an amazingly wide range of ideas, and I would go home completely overwhelmed by Yukuli's, by the sheer breadth of her thoughts and ideas and plans. And I must admit, on more than one occasion, I did sort of hint that maybe she should focus a little more. Fortunately, she paid no attention to me, so. Yukuli grew up in in the Western Highlands of Papua New PNG, in a remote village where there was a few days' walk to the nearest school or the nearest health clinic. And in 2014, I was lucky enough to be driven from Mount Hagen to a town not far from where Yukuli went to school. And we literally drove into the sunset through some of the most rugged, beautiful terrain, mountainous terrain that I've ever been in. And I was quite happy to see that from a nice, well-sprung four-wheel drive vehicle that I wouldn't have liked to have had to walk. Yukuli is actually one of a number of young women that I've met or read about who refuse to allow hardship and poverty to be a barrier. And they're women intent on improving the world, not only for themselves, but for the generations to come. And I'd just like to conclude with just a quote from your website. In my village, there was no school, no health facility, and no infrastructure. Even today, nothing has changed, and people are still living in poverty. Now we are working to ensure the next generation have opportunities for education, healthcare, and economic development. We just need to give them a chance. Welcome, Yukuli, and we look forward to hearing some of your story.
Sorry, I'm not used to this, so you got to be patient with me. Thank you so much, Dr. Colin, for that really comprehensive introduction. I feel actually so special to be here with you this morning because almost the center of the church is really holding Papua New Guinea in a really special way with all these displays. And, Doc, what you've done is, yeah, it's just amazing. Thank you so, so much. And thank you so much for giving me this privilege to be able to stand here and, you know, share with you what I've been involved in over the years. I've got to probably apologize up front that my talk isn't related to the readings or anything like that, so I hope you don't mind. So if I'm kind of, my accent is a bit heavy as well, so if you're having a problem, I'm happy to answer questions afterwards. So I'd like to start just to kind of introduce this funny, weird thing called Soil Child. Soil Child is actually a program, but it's a philosophy as well as a story and experience and a reality of one part of the world where I come from. So that name fits perfectly well to give me the drive and passion and the dream to move forward and do something to fight inequality in the world. So the name sort of resonates with the way that people interact with the natural environment in order to sustain their existence and use their inner capabilities and agency in order to drive or bring forth that change. So that's where that name comes from. It's not just a name, but it's a brand, it's a philosophy, and it's a story which binds that dream together. So I'll probably begin by, you've already heard so much about PNG from Doug and others, but I'd like to just go through a few more things which is happening in PNG at the moment. So we are at the top of Australia, as you know. I think so many people here have already been to Papua New Guinea, like Doug and others. So we're not actually far from you. We got political independence from Australia in 1975, September 16. We have 22 provinces. So we are a small country in terms of geography, but because of the diversity that Doug referred to earlier, people are so scattered in many different small villages and islands. And so we'd like to make a province every maybe 5 years. For example, my province was granted by the National Cabinet in 2012.
So 87% of our population live in the rural sector. So when I say rural sector, people depend on agriculture or just basic gardening and fishing and hunting for food and for other aspects of livelihood. So they don't have cars, they don't have, you know, they don't sleep in good permanent homes, they haven't got water supply, they haven't got, for example, Colin was referring to the nearest school or hospital. You have to walk for certain days to access those services. So that's basically just a rural simple life. 87% of that 7.3 million people actually live in the rural sector. In terms of our socioeconomic situation, sorry, I'm not used to this. Over 40% of our population is actually living in relative poverty. So that's a lot of people, not just not having money, but a lot of people do not have education, do not have access to healthcare, do not have good nutrition. Papua New Guinea has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the Western Pacific region to start with. Maternal mortality rate is actually very high, especially in the rural sector, because women do not have access to services when it comes to going through pregnancy and giving childbirth. So women die from bleeding, from complications. The child dies in a womb because the service, the basic service isn't there. Women are giving birth in the bushes or in the caves. And you can imagine, they do not know how to manage those complications when they are confronted with them because the services aren't that rich. So that's where we end up with a lot of women dying in childbirth. Our literacy rates is one of the worst, is one of the worst. And women are more illiterate compared to men because of the gender differences, where men probably have access to education or school fees more than women. Women are expected to stay at home and do gardening and look after kids. So that's why the illiteracy rate is unequal between men and women, where women are more disadvantaged than men. It's actually changing, I have to say, over the last few years, but it has been worse when I was growing up. So I'm just going to quickly go through parts of my own story just to resonate with what I've just mentioned. So in terms of primary health care, my mom gave birth to me in a cave. In this really remote village. My village is still really far from access to any basic infrastructure. The last time I was in PNG, I had to walk 4 hours from where the public transport had stopped. Public transport, you're talking about a big diner where you use it for containers and things like that here. That's the only truck that can reach these isolated villages because the roads are so terrible. So when I was up there, yeah, it was... It kind of went backwards a bit, I have to say. So my mom gave birth to me in a cave, and I was expected to be a boy child because I was the firstborn child of my mom, who was a daughter of a chief, who married a chief. So cultural expectation was that she was meant to have a firstborn child for her firstborn child, a male child. And I happened to be a girl and a small for dates, which means... You're born at 9 months, but you're smaller than what you're supposed to weigh. And so my mom got a little bit nervous because society was going to really despise her for, you know, and blame her for giving birth to this really small four-day-old girl for her firstborn child, right? So I was born and left in the cave, and my grandmom came along, and I grew up with her. So I haven't had the chance to bond with my mom. I grew up with my grandmother. And then when I was about 6 or 7 years old, at the age of going to primary school, there wasn't any school in the village. So in 1982, I guess, the first primary school opened ever in many generations. It opened, and I was about 5, 6 years old, and they were enrolling students. They were enrolling students, and I was still quite stunted. I was still short. So they said, oh, we can't enroll you. The school committee said, we can't enroll you because you're too small and there are other, you know, hundreds of children competing to go to school. So I thought, no, I need to go to school. And my grandmother said, you need to go to school. So I went and enrolled myself and sat in the class. And the teacher said, oh, she's, you know, she's so desperate to go to school, we let her. And we tested out, and I did well, so I continued and finished year six. And then when it was time to go to high school, in PNG, our education system, we have a lot of dropouts. Our education system is not like yours here. So you have to drop out at year six, and then at year eight, and then at year 10 and year 12. So you get four dropouts in that education lifetime, a primary to secondary education lifetime. So I was selected to go to high school, and the nearest high school was 2 days' walk from the village. So you had to carry your belongings with your food and everything and walk 2 days and go and become a boarding student, where they gave you one plate of brown rice with no protein, no vegetables. So that's how you had to survive for the next 4 years to finish your secondary education. So when I was selected to go to high school, the village sat together and they said, because we were like 36 of us selected to go to high school, so the village sat down together and they said, okay, this and this are going to high school, this and this are not. And I was in the no one because I was a girl and still small, so they thought she's going to be insecure and she won't do well at school. So my parents, actually I can remember my uncle paying school fee for my cousin brother. And I wasn't allowed to go to high school. So anyway, I went home and my grandmother said, she gave me a bilum. Doug doesn't have a bilum on his table, so I might give him one. So she gave me a bilum and she put all my sweet potatoes in the bilum and she said, you have to go, there'll be a road, you follow that road, there'll be people that will show you where you want to go. If you're scared and if you want to return, you can, but there'll be always people and you're going to reach your destination. You have to go. So she forced me. She didn't have any education whatsoever, but she knew. She always told me there's a better world somewhere and you have to pursue. You have to work hard. You have to be determined. So I trusted her. And I took a lot of risks because of her as well. So I went and I came to the school and I finished my year 10. And went on to a nursing college and became a nurse. I was working in one of the other provinces in PNG, in Gulf province. I was working in a hospital there, and they said, oh, you need to come to this conference in Port Moresby. And I went thinking there was a conference, but there was some arrangement where I had to marry someone whom I didn't met before. And got lured into it and had two beautiful sons, and then after all, the marriage didn't work, so I had to divorce him, and that was another risk I took, because in PNG, culturally, our customary marriage is legal in the system. So if you marry through an arranged marriage by your family or your community, that's legal. So when I wanted to divorce my children's father, I was actually breaking that law. And so I was despised by my community for 2 years. And that happened in 2008. So that's actually when I was going through that depression and, well, I was quite depressed. And that stressful stage in my life, that's when the Israel Child Vision actually was born. So I kind of gathered together women who kind of understood what I was talking about, and we started to frame a vision where we could really voice for the exploitation and the violence that was not only physical but psychological, as well as access into services and choices and opportunities that you can have. So that's when the dream started to develop. So that's my village. I kind of make use of the opportunity to give some awareness and education to my community to understand about rights and how people can use those resources to share equally, not because you are men, so you can have more than women, but to be equal. So just to cut the story really short, I divorced my children's father and I got a scholarship. So I went to Melbourne and completed my degree in Melbourne in 2002. And then in 2011, I got another scholarship. So I finished my master's in international development at Flinders University. And that's when I got an award from Julia Gillard when she was your prime minister. So that's our photo in Canberra. And that's how I stayed back on here, because when I got that award, my Swell Child vision really became really strong and it was selling to wider stakeholders. And so that's where it's built to this stage. So Swell Child, what is it about? Colin mentioned some things that we're doing already. But the main focus is to address poverty in the rural areas of Papua New Guinea. It's focusing on that 87% of the population that live in the rural sector. And the main philosophy or the main framework that underpins this idea is that poverty, we don't view poverty just as not having money. So the idea where poverty has to be defined is if you are to have money to be able to buy good clothes and cars and sleep in a good house and have everything else that you need and you want as well, in order to get to that stage, you have to have some sort of an education and information to be able to do that, to discover the capacity and your agency within to come forward and to be able to work towards your progress. So the idea with this meaning of poverty is that in order to have that, come to that stage where you are now aware and you have the information to be able to progress, to work towards your progress, you need to go to school. And if you are to go to school, you can't go to school if you didn't have a school, right? So you have to have a school. But if you had a school, that school has to be functional. So you need the teachers to be there. You need the classrooms to be working. You need tables, desks, and chairs in the classrooms. You need books for both teachers and students. You need all of that infrastructure to be able to create a very friendly environment for children to go to school and learn. If you don't have that, you cannot go to the next stage. If we talk about healthcare, in order to access information about how to look after yourself, how to go access health services when you are sick, how to understand what's going on in your body, how to eat healthy, how to do exercises, all of these things, in order to get that information, you need education. If you're making a lot of money, like for example, in my community, there's a oil and gas mining going on at the moment. Well, it started many years ago, but it's still going on. And they give royalty and equity money to the landowners because the in PNG we own the land, the land is culturally or tribally owned. So when the government wants to develop a part of a land, they have to sign an agreement with the landowners. So when the mining and the petroleum development is taking place, the government and the developers have an agreement with the landowners that they're going to drill the resources out or take the resources out, and the landowners are paid this portion of money called royalty and equity. Now, people do not have money literacy. They don't know how to use the money wisely in order to benefit their children and themselves. For example, paying school fees or good nutrition for their homes. People do not have this money literacy. All of a sudden, you come and give a lot of money. They go and spend it in the cities and towns on junk food, on gambling, on drugs and alcohol, and this is where the social problems is coming out from. And we begin to blame the individuals. We say, oh, you're a bad person, so you're creating problems in the community, or you're getting into crime, or we blame the individual. But they do it because of the system. So we need to understand and tackle the system. So that's how Soil Child actually views what this poverty is about. Poverty is not just not having enough money, but it's about a wider interrelated, it's a bigger phenomenon. We need to look at poverty from this bigger phenomenon rather than just focusing only on one thing if we are going to bring change into these sorts of communities. So with Trail Child, I have three components in order to deliver that vision. So we focus on comprehensive primary health care. So the main goal with that is we want to work through our, in PNG, our healthcare is decentralized. So from the national level, it goes to the provincial level, down to the districts, and then down to the periphery, the head post. So the resources flow through the decentralized system. So my focus area is at the district level and the local level. We want to train, for example, village midwives, illiterate village midwives, who have access to their community where they have the skills and the knowledge to be able to help women when they are giving birth, or to know when to refer women when they are giving birth or having complications. That's our focus. We also want to work with the provincial hospitals. Like, for example, in my province, we are now facilitating all the biomedical equipment that has been donated by our Royal Adelaide Hospital here, which has been donated to over 27 countries around the world. So for Papua New Guinea, I'm facilitating that. We're going to take it to the Tari Hospital in my province. And there are some doctors interested to go over there and train our staff, our local staff, and help install those machines. So in that way, our centralized provincial hospitals have the equipment and the capacity to be able to outsource services to the most periphery areas. With universal basic primary education, my focus is to make sure that everyone knows how to read and write. I want to fight this dropout system in the country, but that's going to take so many generations. For now, I want to focus on people who cannot read and write, to make sure that everyone must learn how to read and write. If they can't learn how to read and write, they need basic information in terms of how to captivate their agency, the strength that they can discover within themselves to create a change for themselves using the local resources that they have, for example, land. So how can people be aware and use their local resources to make a change for themselves? So under this education program, I got some funding from a charity group in Taiwan, and we are building a school at the moment, and we're also building a library. So the library concept is new in PNG schools. Most PNG schools do not have libraries. And in my province, this is going to be a first ever library, because the idea is to make the school a social hub. So the whole community can come to the school, come to this library, and learn about all sorts of things, learn about development, cultural change, equality, using local resources for change, empowerment, all of these things. We're trying to use the school as a social hub. So it's a new concept. We're piloting it out in this school, and hopefully, once it's evaluated and the community kind of buys into the idea, we'd like to spread it. And life begins in the soil. It's all about using the land and the gardening and hunting skills that people already know to capitalize on that, so that people can commercialize. People can grow produce which they can also use for their homes, but also sell and make money. So that's the idea behind life begins in the soil. Basically, that's a metaphor. So that's where the soil child is piloting at the moment. So that's my province, the little red dot there. So I'm just showing you some photos of my community. Like I said, my primary school that I went to has been closed. When I finished year six, it was closed in 1987 because the teachers came from other provinces and the infrastructure wasn't there, so they couldn't survive in this bush school. So they had to leave and the school closed down. So all the children from 1988 up until now, they've never been to school. Up until 2015, I should say, because we reopened the school in 2015. So that's the classrooms and students that you can see. So I'm just going to show you a few videos of this school program where we just opened in February when I was up there. So the first video, please.
I'm lying alone with my head on the phone, thinking of you till it hurts. I know you hurt too, but what else could we do? Tormented and torn apart. I wish I could carry your smile in my heart. For times when my life seems so low, it will make me believe what tomorrow could bring. But today doesn't really know.
That's okay, we can stop here.
It's a long video. I don't want to take so much time, so I'll stop here. We'll just quickly go, have a look at the two other ones here. This is a little child contributing to the building. Kind of cute. And then the last video, if you have it there. Yeah, this is children contributing to our new school. I like this quote from Mandela. He says, only powerful tool in to change the world is education. And I truly believe that. So I've gone through all of that. So these are some of the pictures of our warehouse where we've got all the rail outlet supplies that we're trying to ship. So with the shipment of the supplies, I'm looking to raise at least up to $10,000 to buy a four-wheel drive vehicle like this, because that photo there is a land donated to the program by the community in Dauli. So we are going to build our office on that land. And when we take the supplies, we'll have to distribute them to over like 20 different health centers in the province. And the road has been so destroyed by the recent earthquake. I don't know whether people heard about the earthquake. So I'm looking to buy this four-wheel drive so that I can be able to distribute those consumables. So I'm trying to at least raise up to $10,000. I've already got I've made $3,500, and I need $4,500 to be able to. Yeah, it kind of makes sense, and it will serve the purpose for me to take a good car from here rather than buying one in PNG, which would be so not efficient. So I'd like to ask you guys to pray with me on this. And you can keep in touch or find out about all my work and blogs and websites and everything on all these links here. So I think that's all with in terms of the program, Soil Child, and everything else that I wanted to share with you today. I've got photographs of the earthquake. If I have time, I can show them, but otherwise I'm happy to stop here.
Thank you so much, Akuli, for coming and sharing your story with us and for giving us up-to-date information about PNG. You know, we've all grown up knowing about PNG. We've all met people from PNG. We've all had information from missionaries like Doug and many others about life in PNG, and it's great that you've come and shared this with us today.